Every time that God wanted to give an instruction to his people, he would always preface it with a particular introduction. One of those we can find in Leviticus 23, where he says, "Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when you become into the land which I give unto you, and shall reap the harvest thereof, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest unto the priest. And he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted for you. On the morrow after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. And you shall offer that day when you wave the sheaf an he lamb without blemish of the first year for a burnt offering unto the Lord. And that should be reminiscent of the lamb that is to be selected for the Passover as well." So it's sort of telling us that there is a connection. Down to verse 15, "And you shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete." Now that word "complete" is translated in some places as whole or completed. In other words, a certain amount of time has to pass. And it gets very specific. It says, "Even unto the morrow after the 7th Sabbath shall you number 50 days." Now immediately we're tied together with two events. Number one is the wave sheaf offering, which is required to determine which day is the 50th day. And of course we know the 50th day is Pentecost. That's what the name means. We have to ask, why would God present this requirement? And did it become passé in the New Testament? Is that offering still made the way it was originally intended? The answer is partly yes and partly no. Another question is the wave sheaf offering mentioned even in the New Testament? Do we find it there? Again, it's not obvious, but yes, it is there, and we're going to see a couple of places where it's referred to. But from this, we see that there's a direct connection between this particular offering and the day of Pentecost. You basically can't have one without the other. It is an important connection. Now, the wave sheaf was required of a particular echelon of people. It wasn't just anyone. It was the laborer. It was the farmer. It's the one who produced the grain. A caring farmer. And he didn't offer the offering himself. He had to bring it to the priest to wave it. And not just any old time. He had to bring it at a particular time. In fact, a particular time of day, as we realize from the New Testament example. But the wave sheaf is unique. You don't go to the calendar and find out what's wave sheaf day. It isn't on there. The wave sheaf is determined by a very unique method. Now, God gave instructions just before the Exodus for them to reorient their calendar. The one instruction he gave directly about the calendar was the matter of when the first month of the year would be. And that was specifically the month of green ears. That's what the name for that month means, the Abib. It's the first ripe barley. And it was the first ripe barley that was the key to determining when the whole holy day calendar would begin. It was kind of a judgmental situation. Like I say, it wasn't a fixed calendar date. Never was. Never was meant to be. The priests would have to examine the ripening barley 2 to 3 weeks ahead of time and project whether that barley was going to be ripe enough to be offered as a wave sheaf offering. It had to be sufficiently ripened to be acceptable. So that was important. Now, there's kind of a strange thing with the calendar, because the original calendar, in fact, the biblical calendar that we use today, is lunar. It's a lunar calendar. It depends on the phases of the moon. A lunar month is 29 and a half days. That's why some months are 29 days, some are 30. But there's a problem with that, because 12 lunar months is only 254 days. It's 11 days short of a solar year. So something has to be done to keep the lunar calendar in sync with the solar calendar so that your harvest seasons don't slip out of season with the solar year. The Abib, or the first ripening barley, had something to do with that. If it were determined that the barley is not going to be ripened enough for the wave sheaf offering, they would delay the start of the new year by adding a 13th month. And that has to be done about a third of the time to keep the lunar calendar in sync with the solar calendar. But it was the Abib that determined which month would be the first month of the year. And from there, the whole array of holy days is based on the wave sheaf. Now, it's not a major observance. It's not a high day. But it's a day that was key to determining the calendar. The thing about the wave sheaf offering is that it represents the first of the first fruits. We know who the first fruits are. In fact, that's the instruction that's mentioned in Leviticus 23. The first fruits of your harvest. The important aspect of the wave sheaf is that it represents the first fruits. And in this case, the first of the first fruits. And we know who that is. The first of the first fruits harvest are, of course, Jesus Christ. He is our wave sheaf. He is the one who was presented to the Father to be accepted for us. And that's what we need to realize, and that's what makes the significance of this particular day. Now, what about the first fruits? We often hear of them. The book of Revelation talks about them. They're mentioned in Corinthians. But the first fruits, is that a reward, being one of the first fruits? Is that a reward? Or is it an assignment? Because first fruits aren't for nothing. They're called for a purpose. God has a plan to use them. The first fruits are especially important to him and to his work and to his overall plan. But the suggestion of there being first fruits implies there are others. There are other fruits to come. What do we know about second fruits? Of course, being in the first is special. One thing we know about God's holy days is that they are harvest-oriented. In Old Testament times, they thought of the physical grain harvests or the produce harvests. We think of it more being a harvest of humanity. That's what God is working on, is the harvest of humanity. But the wave sheaf is a harvest function. It begins a season of harvest, the first implying that there is a second harvest season. And of course, the harvest that's associated with Pentecost is first fruits. That whole span of time between the wave sheaf offering and Pentecost is the first fruits season, leading to the Feast of First Fruits. That's what we call Pentecost, the Feast of First Fruits. And of course, the Feast of First Fruits puts a capstone on the end of that harvest period. In Revelation 14, we're given a picture of these harvests, both of them. Revelation 14 is quite interesting in what it reveals. In about verse 4, and this is talking about those that we understand to represent the first fruits. It's talking about the 144,000 redeemed from the earth, but in verse 4 it says, "These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb." But that's not the end of the harvest. That is merely the summation of the first harvest. There is another harvest to come, and that's pictured in the latter part of the same chapter, which talks about the harvest of all of humanity. There's a difference there. But it was important for the priests to assess the readiness of the first ripening barley. It requires a judgment call. They had to make a projection. It wasn't hard and fast determination. They had to project. They had to look forward. They had to assess whether or not in 2 to 3 weeks that standing grain would be ready to be offered as a adequately ripened first fruits offering. And as I mentioned before, 11 lunar months is 11 days short of a full solar year. They need to add a 13th month roughly every third year. But that's not mechanical either. That's not mathematical. It's something that has to be determined by making a judgment call. We can see that judgment is a factor in determining the ripeness, the readiness of the offering. Those who are familiar with the calendar issues probably are familiar with what's called the Metonic cycle, and that is that roughly every 19 years, there's a repeat. And that's credited to the Babylonians. We know that since the 6th century BC, they'd been using it. It probably goes back a long ways before that. But you can sort of predict, you can sort of project ahead as to what the calendar would be doing 19 years forward. Now, the wave sheaf offering falls between the 15th day and the 21st day of the first lunar month. In other words, it falls within the days of unleavened bread. But the projected readiness needs to be assessed in the waning days of the 12th month to know whether or not they should be adding a 13th month. Now we can say, what's the point of that? What's the significance of that? Well, We sort of deal with the significance of that every time we observe God's holy days, because it had been determined by the Abib at some point in the past. The first ripe barley represents the start of the first harvest, the early harvest. The first harvest is pictured being completed by the day of Pentecost. And there's an important message right there. And that message is that there are two harvests. Anyone familiar with God's plan understands there are two harvests. I won't say that the world in general understands that, but let's go to James chapter 5, verse 7. And this is something I've known from my past in the Baptist church as a kid. They talked about this a bit. But it's the early and the latter rains. James 5, verse 7. Be patient, therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waits for the precious fruit of the earth and has long patience for it until he receives the early and the latter rain. There's a huge amount of information in that one passage. The coming of the Lord. So if it's identified for us who this is talking about. The husbandman, that's the Lord. He is waiting for the precious fruit of the earth. In this case, it's not talking about physical produce. It's talking about the people that he is preparing for his harvest. He has long patience for it. There's a long time plan being worked. The time that I spoke on the divided kingdom was a time or two ago. We sort of talked about that. God has had a long-term plan. It's been going on for a good 3,000 years that we can document, where he has divided his people into two elements that he is using to bring forth his plan for humanity. But his interest is in the harvest of humanity. That's the harvest he's talking about. And it mentions, finally, the early and the latter rain. There are two harvests. One is the result of the early rain, and one is the result of the latter rain. That's important to understand because it factors into what we're talking about. Now, the barley that was to be used for the wave sheaf offering was cultivated barley. It wasn't something that grew on its own. It wasn't wild barley. It wasn't seed that happened to get scattered accidentally. It wasn't something dropped by birds. The barley that counted was the barley that was purposely raised by the farmer. It was seed cultivated by a caring and dedicated farmer. We read that earlier in Exodus 23:16 talks about that. That wasn't the same passage. Exodus 23, verse 16, and that makes it clear that this was not just anything that grew on its own. I'm going to start with verse 14 just to get the context here of where we are. Three times you shall keep the feast unto me in the year. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. You shall eat unleavened bread 7 days as I commanded you. In the time appointed of the month Abib, for in it you came out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty. And the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors, and that's the first harvest, which you have sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering, which is in the end of the year, when you has gathered in your labors out of the field. We can see there also two harvest periods, the harvest of first fruits, and later in the year, the harvest of ingathering. So there's two harvest periods, but the one that we're focusing on is the one that begins with the wave sheaf offering. What does the wave sheaf have to do with harvesting anyway? Couldn't you harvest your grain whether you offered a wave sheaf or not? That's how it's done in most of the world. They don't even think about this particular offering. Well, we've seen how it may affect the calendar, and that, of course, has to do with how and when we observe God's holy days. But the harvesting, in that society at least, began on wave sheaf day, what we could call phase one of God's harvest plan of humanity. Because you see, it became ceremonially legal to harvest once the wave sheaf is offered. They offered the wave sheaf that Sunday morning, the Sunday morning after the seventh Sabbath is completed. Then they could go out into their fields and begin the harvest in earnest. Now think about what that means. That means that the Sunday of the wave sheaf offering was a work day. See the implication of that. If God intended Sunday to be a Sabbath day, that contradicts the wave sheaf offering. So for those who would want to think that the early New Testament church shifted from a Sabbath-keeping organization into a Sunday-keeping one, they've got that little problem. They have to ignore the wave sheaf and what it means. Now, the wave sheaf was key to the receipt of God's Spirit. Think about that, because that's what took place on that day of Pentecost in the first century. Legally, they couldn't begin the harvest until the wave sheaf offering had been offered up. Now, this tells us something also about the calendar situation. We think of the calendar in the terms of the solar calendar that we have to deal with. But in the ancient world, it's quite different. Most societies back then operated under a lunar calendar. We think Rome was different. No, originally it was not. I think we've all heard of the term the Ides of March. Do you recall what that refers to? In the Roman world, the Ides of March was the full moon that occurred within the month of March. Now that tells us, or that gives us an example, that the early Roman calendar was lunar. And that the first month of their calendar was March. Now think about September, October, November, December. In Latin, that's 7, 8, 9, 10. December is the 10th month on the original Roman calendar, at least of that period of time. Which meant their new year began 2 or 3 months later. Now, it was the sun worshippers who changed to a solar calendar. Perhaps we could say the Mithraists. I'm not sure exactly who it would be credited to. But that's how it happened, that the calendar got changed, where New Year now begins at midnight ending the 10th month. But the Ides of March is interesting, because the first, or the full moon of the month of March would have been the first day of unleavened bread. Did you ever think about that? Now, what made the Ides of March famous was, of course, the assassination of Julius Caesar. That's probably where that term gained so much use. But the Greek world didn't use the Julian calendar. That was more of a Roman determination, effective about 46 BC, give or take. But the Roman calendar also used to begin in the spring. So a vestige of the old and the original Roman calendar remains even in the names of the days of our months. So lunar months are not unique to the Jewish or the Old Testament religion. It was common in the world in the years BC. The early New Testament church observed the wave sheaf prescription, even evangelized Gentiles. Did you realize that? In 1 Corinthians 16, and I had asked earlier, is the wave sheaf mentioned in the New Testament? And the answer is, perhaps not directly, but 1 Corinthians 16, there's a very interesting passage. Because there was something going on in the world of that time. There was a famine. It was affecting the eastern Mediterranean. Paul instructed the churches of Galatia and Corinth to take up and prepare food offerings to relieve the brethren in Judea. Chapter 16, verse 1. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, he wanted them to do the same thing. And here's the interesting verse, and it's amazing what the world has done, the world of religion has done with verse 2. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store, as God has prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. Now, from the time I was a kid, I remember hearing this verse explained. This is the verse they used to justify going to church on Sunday. I mean, this isn't talking about the first day of the week, isn't it? Strange comment here. Paul says that he doesn't want there to be any gatherings when he comes. Now that alone should throw up a huge question mark. The Apostle Paul is going to come to this congregation or this region in Corinth, but he doesn't want there to be any gatherings when he comes. Now if this is talking about going to church on Sunday, wait a minute. Because we don't understand the wave sheaf offering, this verse sails right by the comprehension of most people. Let me explain to you what he's really talking about here. They're gathering up foodstuffs. They're putting it up, which would in effect drying it or preparing it for a long voyage. And they were to do it on what he calls the first day of the week. That's how it's translated. And people think that's talking about Sunday. Yes, it's talking about Sunday, but not just any Sunday, not every Sunday, a particular Sunday. Because you see, these Corinthians understood about the ceremonial legality of harvesting their foodstuffs before the wave sheaf offering. They understood the wave sheaf offering. And Paul was instructing them without having to explain, because they already understood. He was instructing them to begin this putting aside of their harvest on a particular day. And it's not the first day of any old week. The actual meaning of that passage is the first day of weeks. Weeks is plural there. Upon the first day of weeks, let every one of you lay by him in store. They were to go out into their fields and begin harvesting and begin preparing their food for a journey. Because somebody was going to pass through the region at some undetermined time. And they didn't want to have to wait for people to go gather their stuff then. They wanted to have it ready ahead of time. But what this tells us is the Corinthians understood the ceremonial legality of harvesting their grain, which would have been the first thing ripe. It wouldn't have been melons. It wouldn't have been grapes. It wouldn't have been produce. I mean, fruit tree produce. It was basically the first ripe barley. That was the first thing that they were to begin gathering. But the Corinthians understood what he meant. The first day of weeks was the day when it became ceremonially legal to do so. So there's a hidden message there that most people don't get. And those that think of talking about passing the offering plate in church on Sunday morning, which is, you'll hear that explanation somewhere, but not the point at all. That's what we need to understand. And verse 3 sort of reinforces it. And when I come, whomsoever you shall approve by your letters, them will I send to bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. This isn't talking about passing an offering plate. This is talking about putting up foodstuffs to relieve the famine that was going on in Judea. But the time when he said to begin doing that, so that they're all on the same page, so that they're all doing the same thing, was the first day of weeks. Now, what was the first day of weeks? That was the first day of the count of 50 days to the Feast of Weeks. So the early New Testament church, even Gentile areas, understood this, which most people don't understand today. The early New Testament church lived with a different awareness than do modern Christians. In Luke chapter 6, there is another reference, and this one is particularly potent and interesting. Again, misunderstood because it doesn't square with people's modern day understanding. First five verses of chapter 6, Luke chapter 6. Picture this, because this is really important. And it came to pass on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the cornfields, and his disciples plucked the ears of corn and did eat, rubbing them in their hands. What was wrong with that? Apparently some people had some issues with that. Verse 2, and certain of the Pharisees said unto them, why do you that which is not lawful to do on the Sabbath days? And Jesus answered them and said, have you not read so much as this, what David did when he himself went and hungered, and they which were with him? How he went into the house of God and did take and eat the showbread and give also to them that were with him, which is not lawful to eat, but for the priests. And he said unto them that the Son of Man is Lord also of the Sabbath. Now this is another favorite passage where people like to diminish the applicability of Sabbath keeping. Again, not the point at all. What were they doing that was, quote-unquote, unlawful? We can see what the accusation was, and it was a double accusation. They were doing something that was unlawful, but also doing it on the Sabbath day. There's a double accusation there, and Christ came back with a double response. It's important to notice that. But what was the real problem here? There's a clue to what the problem was right up there in verse 1. The second Sabbath after the first. What was that? That's not any old Sabbath. That is a particular Sabbath. The Greek is deuteroproto-sabbaton. It's a single Greek word. It tells us that it is the second, quote-unquote, first Sabbath. What is a first Sabbath? To have a second first Sabbath, you need to have a first Sabbath, do you not? What does that term mean? Here again, because people don't understand the wave sheaf offering, they're all over the map on trying to explain what this is talking about. Let me explain to you what it is. There were two major methods of counting Pentecost. One began with the first Sabbath, and the other one began with the second first Sabbath. And actually, there's a third, not so well known, and I don't know if it's described in the New Testament, but history will give it to you. But the Pharisees' first Sabbath was the morrow after the first day of unleavened bread. That was the first Sabbath. It's not the one that Jesus and his disciples and the early New Testament employed. They used the second first Sabbath. The second first Sabbath was the Sabbath, the morrow after the Sabbath that falls within the 7 days of unleavened bread. And that is the Sabbath on which the wave sheaf is offered. It's not the Pharisaical wave sheaf, but it's the Sadducean wave sheaf. And the Essenians counted from the morrow after the last day of unleavened bread. So they came up with Sivan 12. But the one that's important here is this second first Sabbath, which is an endorsement of the Sadducean method of counting, which is the one we use. That's why Pentecost for us is a weekly Sunday, every time. With the other count methods, it isn't. It'll move around on the calendar. It'll move around in which day of the week it is. But Pentecost is a Sunday. The Pentecost that we read of in Acts chapter 2 is a Sunday. It should be. That's the day that you come up with if you start counting from the second first Sabbath. So do we understand that term? Now, here's where it gets interesting. Let's go over to Matthew 12. Because this is an account of the same incident. Matthew 12, verse 6. And you'll see the same explanation from verse 3 on that we had just read in Luke chapter 6. Let me read the whole thing from verse 3. But he said unto them, have you not read what David did when he was an hungered, and they that were with him? He's talking about a case of necessity. How that he entered into the house of God and did eat the showbread, which was not legally lawful for him to eat, neither for them which were with him, but only for the priests. Or have you not read in the law? He's talking about the law here. How that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath and are blameless. The priests did their laborious work on the Sabbath day, and that was legally prescribed. So he's showing that their view of Sabbath observance was maybe a little bit off center. But look at verse 6. He says, "But I say unto you that in this place is one greater than the temple." Now he's talking to Pharisees. He's talking to the Pharisees that had the assignment of watching that field. "In this place is one greater than the temple." How would a Pharisee react to that? Apparently there's no negative reaction at all. What is he saying? Because you see, they thought he was talking about the thing that was there in that field being greater than the temple. When in actually he's talking about himself being in that field, being greater than the temple. What this tells us is that day, which was the second first Sabbath, was day one, or just before day one, of the count to Pentecost, which tells us that that wave sheaf was still there in that field. That's what the Pharisees thought he was saying. That's why they were fine with what he said. If they thought he was talking about himself being greater than the temple, we'd probably still hear the echoes of the boom. Okay? They would have gone berserk. So that tells us that the wave sheaf was still in that field on the second first Sabbath. It hadn't been legally offered before that. It was still there. And this was a lesson for his disciples about the wave sheaf offering, which was about to be offered the next morning, day one of the count to Pentecost. If this incident had happened a day later, it would have never been an issue. Nobody would have cared. But they were violating the wave sheaf field. That's why it was being watched. They were violating the wave sheaf field by taking of some of its grain and eating it then and there before it was ceremonially legal to do so. So to answer the question, does the New Testament talk about the wave sheaf offering? And the answer is, yes, it does, but in an indirect way. It speaks to those who know the ceremony and what it means. But in so doing, Jesus Christ was declaring himself to be our wave sheaf offering, greater than the temple. We don't need the temple once we have his offering. Now, the temple is fine for its services, but we don't look to the temple. We look to him, the wave sheaf, who was offered for us. There's another place that talks about this, and it's in Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. I think it's about verse 13. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. "And I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days. And they brought him near before him." Now we got two beings here. One is referred to as the Ancient of Days. The other is referred to as one like the Son of Man. So at this moment in time, when this is happening, the Son of Man is being brought before and waved before the Ancient of Days to be accepted. It was essential that he be accepted, because without his sacrifice being accepted by the Father, There's nothing. All of our faith is vain. His resurrection is essential. His presentation before the Father to be accepted for us as our wave sheaf offering is essential. Now we remember the passage where Jesus encountered Mary early in the morning, that Sunday morning, after he had been resurrected. We remember where he says, "Touch me not, for I have not yet ascended to the Father." But he says, "Go tell my brethren, I'm about to." It's in John 20, verse 17. We know that passage. That was that very morning. What we just read in Daniel 7 is what happened only moments after that encounter. His first ascension, after being conceived, after growing up as a human being, his first ascension back to the Father, the first time that the two had been in each other's direct presence for some 34 years, was on Wave Sheaf Day. That morning, the Sunday morning after his resurrection. And he didn't enter on his own. He was presented by others. Notice it there in Daniel 7, 13. He was presented by others. They brought him near before him. Again, the priesthood acting as the intermediary to present the wave sheaf to God. The farmers didn't wave their wave sheaf on their own. Jesus was our wave sheaf, presented for us. His acceptance in that capacity was necessary. Without Jesus as our wave sheaf, then none of the holy day events are effective. Not those that deal with personal salvation and not those that represent world salvation. He was the first of the first fruits harvest. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 15, where we had been earlier. 1 Corinthians 15. Well-known passage. Verse 20 and 23. "But now is Christ risen from the dead and become the first fruits of them that slept." Down to 23. "But every man will follow on in his own order, Christ the first fruits, afterward they that are Christ's at his coming." So there's the beginning of that harvest period, which is Christ being presented as the first fruits, and there is a conclusion to that period of first fruits harvest that occurs at his coming. So let's not dismiss, let's not minimize this essential observance. Even though we don't mark it, even though we don't necessarily do anything different on that day, let's at least recognize what it is, what it's for, because it's all important. It determines the calendar. It is essential. It is the benchmark for setting up the whole structure of holy days for the remainder of the year. So let's not dismiss it. Let's not consider it irrelevant, because without it, there'd be no Pentecost.